Justice Antonin Scalia, whether you loved him or whether you hated him, and either way, you had plenty of company, he's gone now. He has left the bench and left us for a better place. The practical problem we face now, the constitutional problem we face now, is what happens after Justice Scalia. President Obama has the constitutional power to appoint someone, but the Senate has the power to confirm or not. And right now, it looks more like an or not than a confirmation. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and today we're going to discuss what happens after Justice Scalia.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
I was as shocked as anyone else was when I learned of the passing of Justice Antonin Scalia. But as soon as I got over my shock and as soon as I started thinking, like the rest of the country is thinking, about what's going to happen next, I noticed, just like you did, that the president declared his intention to appoint a successor, and the Senate just as quickly announced its intention not even to consider one. And so my next thought was that I need a political expert. And whenever I need a political expert, I think of my buddy, Jim Melcher.
My name is James P. Melcher. I teach political science at the University of Maine at Farmington, including civil liberties and constitutional law.
Those sound like fascinating topics. And of course, you have a particular tool that you use in your classes that seems to me to be the best tool that one can use outside of a classroom setting.
Stuart, I would never call you a tool. You must mean your podcast. Yeah, in a number of my classes, American Government, Civil Liberties, and Constitutional Law, I've made an extensive number of podcasts of your program, your weekly Constitutional, available for students, especially for the intro students that are often not really that versed in matters of the law. It's a tremendous opportunity for them, and it's very popular. I've had students say they've become regular listeners to the program. People enjoy it. So it's been a tremendous teaching tool for me, and anything that gets students to pay more attention and love the course more is good. So thank you, Stuart Harris, and your weekly Constitutional.
Well, you're more than welcome, Jim. That's very gratifying to hear. You've mentioned this before, so I guess I really kind of knew that you did that. But that's something that actually happens in a lot of classrooms across the country. I've heard from college professors. I've heard from law professors. I've heard from even teachers in high school who will use this, as appropriate. Some episodes are a bit more accessible than others. And they find it a very good teaching tool. And indeed, I should mention, in my own introductory constitutional law class, I used to assign a fair amount of outside reading, outside the case book. Current events, that sort of thing. But I find now that I simply assign a podcast, basically one a week, for outside the classroom learning, and it's been a good adventure. So enough of me patting myself on the back or patting the show on the back, but it's very gratifying, and it's very nice to speak to you again. We've spoken before.
We have. On two occasions, I filed an amicus brief on behalf of a T-shirt participant on popular sovereignty. And then we had a lovely chat with our wives and one of your really impressive alumni or current student, I guess, in Philadelphia, talking about the City Tavern. We both happened to be in town for a conference and had a fine chat there about the City Tavern and how people in that era would work together.
Yes, we did. It was a great time. Mo Bryant was the young lady who was our student at the time. And as you mentioned, both of our beautiful wives were there. And it was just a lovely evening. And you filled in a lot of the history of the City Tavern, which was one of the taverns where the delegates to the Constitutional Convention stayed in Philadelphia. It's been beautifully restored there. And there's an entire episode on it. So if people want to listen in on what we did there, Google our podcast, Your Weekly Constitutional. And then search for the City Tavern episode, and I think you'll enjoy it. But okay, now we know who you are, and that's really not what we're here to talk about, though. As fascinating as you are, what we really want to to tap into is your expertise.
I think we're going to talk about the vacancy on the Supreme Court. I understand you're going to put your name up for it and see if President Obama will send you there.
I've received several messages from the president, but I just decided I didn't necessarily want to go through the process this time around.
Mm. Well, I think that's what the Republicans are banking on. I think they've set a shot across the bow of anybody who might want to consider running. People are thinking, do I really want to put myself through this for a year for something that may not get there? So I think it's a positive, I mean, not a positive strategy, but I think it's an intentional strategy to try and discourage people from applying. That, you know, rough things will happen to you if you try and apply, and you may be wasting your time. So don't leave that day job just yet.
Absolutely. And that's why I wanted to call you, Jim, because you know all about these political things and things that don't even occur to me. Let's just start with the constitutional aspect. A lot of people are asking, well, wait a second. This current impasse between the president, who says he is going to nominate somebody to replace Justice Scalia and may do so any day, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, the leadership of the United States Senate, which has actually signed pledges saying that they are not going to consider any nominee by this president, that they're going to simply stonewall until a new president is elected and it takes office in 2017. Let's just talk about that for a moment. There are some people who suggest that that's not constitutional. What do you think?
Well, I think the president clearly under Article 2 has an obligation to send a name forward. I don't think it's as clear that the Senate has an obligation to necessarily act on it unless you want to say, well, that seems to infer that they have to. But there's no time limit specified in the Constitution. The Supreme Court can and has in the past operated with fewer than 9 people. It's a little bit like being in the penalty kill in a hockey game. You can play it less than full strength. So while it may seem logical or perhaps in many ways desirable for them to act on a nominee, who of course they could always reject later, certainly saying they're going to act on a nominee in no way obligates them to exactly vote for that person. But I don't see a constitutional requirement that the Senate consider a nominee within a given period of time.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that one. I mean, one can criticize the Senate Republicans from a variety of perspectives, or one can support them. But those are all basically political arguments. There's no requirement in the Constitution that the Senate act within any particular time. And indeed, the very concept of consent suggests that a lack of consent is part of the equation.
One of the things that I think your listeners should be aware of is sometimes people think there must be some temporary person you put on. My students have been asking me about this. Is there some line of succession? Is there someone you plug in? And I think it's important for people to understand that not only isn't there, but the Constitution does not mandate a specific number of members of the Supreme Court. It oscillated for years until, I think, 1869 it got settled. Furthermore, there are many occasions where a justice will recuse her or himself. Justice Kagan, on a number of cases, recused herself from cases that she dealt with when she had been in the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, it's desirable to have 9. You're less likely to have ties when you have 9. In a lot of ways, it would be a good thing if they moved as quickly as possible. And some presidents, like President Eisenhower, in his appointment of William Brennan in 1956, were very conscious of saying, I want the Supreme Court to be at full strength when they begin next October in their new term, much as President Obama has. But there's nothing that's a requirement about any of that. The court can and has operated with 8 members in the past.
Indeed, it has. And in fact, we have to recall also that we're talking about the United States Senate, which under Article 1 has the sole authority to set its own rules. And the Senate, in its infinite wisdom, has actually set up a system where, you know, quite literally one senator can block passage of legislation, important legislation, or other things that the Senate might otherwise do. And it's a fairly common tactic within the Senate to simply block things with which a particular senator or group of senators disagrees. And so this can really be seen as sort of a continuum. This is how the Senate operates. And when it doesn't want to cooperate with you, it just basically, you know, holds its breath and stands in the corner until its face turns red.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned holds as the verb. I mean, there have been many cases where senators have placed holds on nominees by the president. A hold is a claim that I need more information to look into this person. It's not precisely the same as the filibuster, which has gotten more attention. But perhaps the most famous example of that was James Hormel, who was the heir to the Hormel fortune. Bill Clinton was trying to appoint him as ambassador to Luxembourg. And a Republican senator, I believe it was James Inhofe of Oklahoma, said, I do not want a gay American ambassador. I think that that's embarrassing for the United States. And he placed a hold on Inhofe's nomination that, as I recall, lasted over a year. So there's the filibuster, the more familiar we're going to prevent debate on this. But the Senate also has that hold tactic by which they nominally are saying they're looking for more info. What's happened to the filibuster is they have become much more common in the last 30 to 40 years, and they become particularly common as not the sole senator standing up. We all think of Jimmy Stewart in his
Mr. Smith goes to Washington, yeah.
Exactly, where he's passionately on the floor of the Senate defending this. That's really not what most filibusters look like. In fact, filibusters can occur today without there actually being debate. You know, mm-hmm. We think of Strom Thurmond in 1957 filibustering a civil rights bill. But a filibuster can simply consist of the parties saying, we're filibustering that. If you bring this up, we will delay it. But the Senate can deal with other business. And ironically, what that's done is make the Senate a lot more willing to use filibusters. They are far more common now than they were 30 or 40 years ago. And both parties have used them. This isn't just, oh, those bad Republicans filibustering. Well, Democrats have filibustered Republican judicial nominees and other appointments, too. So Republicans have done this more frequently. But there's a real change in how filibusters work. And filibusters, of course, are not specifically in the Constitution.
No, we only really bring those into the conversation because, again, the Senate has the constitutional authority to set its own rules, and that's where you get these strange ideas like filibusters, which, as you say, emanates from the idea of unrestricted debate within the Senate. But in its modern iteration, there is no debate. There simply, correct me if I'm wrong now, because you're the political scientist, there's effectively a requirement of a 60-vote supermajority, and that's really fundamentally changed the way the Senate operates.
Well, it has. That's the vote that you need to invoke cloture. And just as a clot stops the flow of blood, cloture stops the flow of debate. And not just judicial nominations, but many pieces of legislation a party will have as a tactic that we will filibuster this, and you're going to need 60 senators. And since neither party typically has 60 senators on its own, what you're really saying is we need bipartisan support for this to happen.
It's a puzzlement. Okay, the ways of the Senate are strange and mysterious to those who are outside of it.
Just like law school, right, Stuart?
Indeed, just like law school. But I think what we've established here is that in all likelihood, you know, the simple refusal of the Senate to act upon the president's nominee, as objectionable as some people find it, is probably well within their constitutional prerogatives. And there's really no way that President Obama can challenge that constitution. I mean, he could try to file some sort of lawsuit that would, you know, make its way eventually to the Supreme Court. But it's unlikely that it would advance anything any more quickly than a political solution. And indeed, it's not even certain that the Supreme Court would ultimately even make such a decision for a variety of reasons we don't have time to go into. So basically, we're stuck. We're stuck in terms of the Constitution. You know, no one's going to make the Senate do what the Senate doesn't want to do, except, of course, the people of the United States. And that's kind of where, really, in some senses, our starting point. And that's really why I wanted to speak to you, because, you know, I do the law stuff, I do the Constitution stuff, but you do the political stuff. And I think ultimately, if there's to be a solution to this impasse, it's going to be a political solution.
Well, I agree. I mean, and to some extent, the impasse itself is political. this could be something that Republicans are taking as a bargaining position that they don't necessarily expect to hold. And there have been Republicans in the Senate, Mark Kirk from Illinois, Susan Collins from Maine, who have said, at least under some circumstances, they would be willing to listen to a would be willing to give a hearing, not necessarily support. That's part of what the hearings are for. But there are some Republicans who would be willing to do that. So a potential solution could involve some of the kinds of senators that have voted to invoke cloture to stop filibusters on other issues to do this. And Kirk is a particularly interesting example because he's not only a relatively moderate senator, he's a senator up for re-election.
Mm-hmm.
He's facing a difficult re-election fight in Illinois. He's got Tammy Duckworth, a decorated Purple Heart veteran congresswoman, running against him. And I think what some people think a potential solution might be is to exert pressure on some of those Republican senators. Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire would be another good example, who are both in difficult re-election fights, who've been willing to support other cloture petitions to stop filibusters. I think if there's going to be a solution, those people are going to be the ones that have some role to play in solving the situation, if in fact that's what winds up happening.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and like you, I'm wondering what's going to happen after the death of Justice Scalia. I'm speaking with my buddy Jim Melcher, who's an expert on American politics. After the break, we'll have a constitutional quiz, and we'll come back and speak some more with Jim Melcher. Stick around. And now here's another constitutional quiz recorded live at the We the People Virginia State Finals 2016 in Colonial Williamsburg.
My name is Scott. I'm from Kemp's Landing Ordination School.
Tremendous. Scott, how old are you?
I am 14 years old.
Okay, you got that one. You're sure? Sure of the age there. Okay, great. Glad got it. Okay. All right, Doug.
Okay. I'm going to read the question. How many answers am I going to give you?
You've given the previous contestants four answers.
Four answers. Here they come. In what state did the Federalist Papers first appear? In what state did the Federalist Papers first appear? Was it in the state of Philadelphia? Was it in the state of Virginia, or the Commonwealth of Virginia, as we probably should say? Was it in the state of Zimbabwe? Yes. Or was it in the state of New York? In what state the Federalist Papers first appear?
Well, Philadelphia is a city, so we can rule that out. I think it was in Pennsylvania, in C, Pennsylvania.
You think it was in Pennsylvania. Now, why do you think it was Pennsylvania?
That was one of the big cities with all the...
Yeah, Philadelphia is in Pennsylvania, and that's a big, important city. Who was the primary author of the Federalist Papers? I'll give you a hint. There's a musical on Broadway about him right now.
Just had an idea.
I believe it was Alexander.
What I'm trying to get at here, Scott, is that a guy by the name of Hamilton was the primary author.
Yeah,
where was Hamilton from?
I think he was from Pennsylvania.
Close.
New York.
New York! He gets New York, is that correct?
New York is New right!
Is. All right, tremendous.
Congratulations!
Scott, well done.
I kind of thought he might pick Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe always was on the top of my list.
Man, we got to...
Chill! I haven't given up this much joy all school year.
And now it's time to return to my conversation with Professor James P. Melcher of the University of Maine at Farmington. Jim's a politics professor. He's an expert on American politics, and he and I have been having a fascinating conversation about what happens after the death of Justice Scalia. As we determined during the first part of the show, the Constitution doesn't really provide an answer. We have to think about politics.
It seemed to me, again, this is a little bit beyond my area of expertise. I like to tell people that constitutional law is simply politics written down. In some sense, that's true, but in another sense, it's really not. I mean, I like to think of the Constitution as being like bumpers in a bowling alley. You put those, you know, when the kids are bowling, you put those inflatable bumpers in the gutters, and it keeps the ball within the alley. And in much the same fashion, the Constitution sets sort of limits on how far left you can go or how far right you can go or exactly what tactics you might use. But within that, within the bowling alley itself, there's a lot of room for different solutions and different political agendas. And that's the realm in which we're in right now. It seems to me that, you know, we're in an election year, and the situation we now face with the unexpected death of Justice Scalia means that the strategy that previously the Republican Senate was embarked upon, the idea of demonstrating that Republicans are capable of governance and that the Republican Party is not merely the party of no, as it's sometimes criticized for being, Mitch McConnell and the Senate Democrats, excuse me, the Senate Republicans didn't want to be seen as obstructionist in an election year, but here they are. And that,
well, that's
I think
what happens when the stakes are high. I mean, this is a really major appointment. That many of the appointments we have seen to the Supreme Court in recent years have swapped out one justice for one who is relatively similar. And both when President Obama appointed Justices Sotomayor and Justices Kagan, that didn't really move things off center that much. Really, the last time you moved things off center was in appointing Justice Alito to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, made things somewhat more conservative, but they were both Republican appointees. Certainly, Sandra Day O'Connor wasn't as liberal as, say, you know, center of the court in the Warren years. She's not William O. Douglas, or she's not Ruth Bader Ginsburg, even. Mm-hmm. This has the chance to move things so far that I think their desire to not seem obstructionist really takes a back seat. And individual senators may well be able to say, well, I'm not an obstructionist. Look at me. I'm going for some of these sort of things. Mitch McConnell doesn't need to care about that nearly as much as somebody like a Senator Kirk that's really looking at this. But one other thing I wanted to get back to the bumpers thing, is one of the things that's different about this than most con law questions is there's no precedent. Mm-hmm. There isn't a night, you know, usually you can turn and say, okay, what's the precedent on the exclusionary rule? What's our precedence on affirmative action? Or what's our precedent on something? There isn't precedent. And as most of your viewers know, you can't establish, the federal courts won't take a case unless there's a live controversy. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite terms, I always like to picture them being like the lobsters in a tank that you can pick out at the restaurant. And I'd like a pound and a half live controversy, but please be sure to use the rake. Well, mm-hmm. The Supreme Court doesn't issue advisory opinions. And that goes back to George Washington.
Right.
Justice Jay told him, we really aren't going to give advisory opinions. We're only going to solve something that's an actual problem with actual people. So you'd have to get quite a ways down the road for the Supreme Court to even consider that. And then you'd also run headlong into one of their prized doctrines, which is called the doctrine of political questions. That the Supreme Court says, well, we think this is a political matter. Political matters should be resolved by the elective branches of government. Now, who decides what a political matter is? Well, by cracky, it's the Supreme Court. But there were a lot of petitions, for example, to stop the Vietnam War during the 1960s. And the Supreme Court said, this is a political question. We're not going to handle this. And I think even if you did somehow get to the point where there was a live controversy, the Supreme Court, I think, would really be reluctant to stick their finger into that pie. I think that they would just rather not take it. I think they'd be likely to decline such a case if it came to them.
I think you're right, Jim. And of course, you've just completely blown up my intention to not get down into the weeds of political questions and issues of standing and all the rest of it. But okay, so that's fine. You filled that in a little bit. So again, we can conclude the Supreme Court itself is not going to step into the middle of this thing. It's going to be resolved politically. And as you have pointed out, there are some relatively moderate Republican senators who are up for re-election. They are the ones who feel perhaps on an individual basis that they need to appeal to the center, to the independent voters, if you will. And those perhaps would be the ones who would not want to be seen as obstructionist in a presidential election year. So perhaps they are vulnerable. Perhaps the Democrats, if they hammer on this situation long enough and hard enough, can convince a few of those Republican senators to defect.
Well, Susan Collins isn't even up for re-election. She's just ideologically committed to that position. Mm-hmm. But Tammy Duckworth, for example, ran banner advertisements. Tell Mark Kirk we want to vote on a Supreme Court. Now, this is already being used as, whether it's an election issue or it really sincerely is an effort to get them to vote on this, one way or another, that's not a theoretical matter. This is something Democrats are already applying, but there's a handful of Republican senators that think on principle that a president should get a vote, whether it's an election year or not.
Right. Now, here's something where we get into politics again. You know, the traditional wisdom is that either party will try, at least in a general election, to appeal to the middle. I've been reading that lately both the Republicans and the Democrats are considering abandoning that strategy and simply trying to energize their bases. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case –
this would be a very good way of doing it.
Right. If that's the case, then nobody's going to compromise. They're simply going to draw that line, not accept any sort of evaluation of a nominee, and simply appeal to their own basis and try to get people to turn out in November. Do you think that possibly that would simply lead to the impasse continuing?
I think it very well could. And there have been other cases where a presidential nomination has carried over into the following presidency. Hoover appointed Benjamin Cardozo that way. It wound up being picked up by Franklin Roosevelt after he came in. I doubt a President Trump or a President Cruz would be interested in moving that forward, but there certainly is precedent for nominees carrying over. But I think there's a very good chance that there will not only not be a new justice approved, I think it's not impossible there won't be any. And this is the kind of issue that motivates the bases of both parties, which, since we're at the presidential nominating phase, may well be the direction people are going to play. You know, there's an old saying that candidates run from the middle in the nominating campaign and run to the middle in the general election campaign. But if you look at who some of these candidates are, how much is Bernie Sanders going to run to the middle? How much is Ted Cruz going to run to the middle? How much is the Donald going to run to the middle? The Donald's going to do what the Donald's going to do. And, you know, I think that we have an unusual class of candidates here who lack that sort of inclination. That said, I think this coming up as an issue is good for some candidates, not as good for others.
Well, here's a wild card aspect. We haven't really talked about this. The X factor is, of course, who President Obama decides to nominate.
Right.
Now, I think there's several different ways he could go. He could try to nominate somebody who is moderate and appeals to everybody. He could try to go left and energize the base. He could even, you know, I think there's been some speculation he might even pick a Republican. But I think the commonality that I've been seeing, at least in the press articles, and I'm not privy to all the president's private deliberations, but is he's going to try to pick somebody who's going to make the Republicans look as bad as possible, somebody who's so highly qualified and unobjectionable that it's going to be very, very difficult for the Republicans to continue stonewalling.
Well, and that may well be. Well, a lot of what he's doing now is throwing up trial balloons. And you mentioned the possibility of appointing a Republican nominee. Last mm-hmm. week, he talked about nominating Governor Sandoval of mm-hmm. Nevada, who mm-hmm. is acceptable to Democrats on certain issues, that he's not particularly pro-life on abortion, which has often been a litmus test issue for Democrats and on the opposite direction for Republicans. And you kind of had the sense the president was being just a smidgen puckish about this. Like, really? No nominee? What if I did this? I mean, I saw some people speculating he would throw Orrin Hatch at them, you know, who is one of the longest lasting Senate Republicans, unimpeachably Republican, or at least, you know, would be before the Tea Party, and say, well, dare you? Let's see you try and swat down Orrin Hatch and see you do that. So he might well do that. Another strategy could be, I'm going to nominate somebody you've already approved for something else. And I think a lot of the speculation that he might choose the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, goes along those lines, where he could say, look, you just vetted her. You just approved of her as Attorney General of the United States. There can't possibly be a smoking gun here that you can use to say that she isn't qualified. And then you also have the issues of race that come into that. So it's a chess game. I mean, I don't want to say it's cynical, but it is a sort. I mean, in some ways, it really is almost a negotiation. I have a different pet theory on what the president ought to do on this.
Okay, please share it with us.
I think a lot of what Republicans really fear is that the president will appoint a young person who will be on the court for a long, long time. When President Bush Sr. appointed Clarence Thomas, I believe Clarence Thomas was 48 years old, and he did it knowing he would be there a long, long time. I've just been reading about President Eisenhower's appointment of William Brennan, which was an example of going across party lines, although in that case, apparently in part to get a Catholic on the Supreme Court, get a state judge on the Supreme Court, and to carry New Jersey in the presidential election, all seemed to have been factored. But Eisenhower said, one of my criteria is nobody under 62. Presidents, knowing they're appointing somebody for life and good behavior, usually want somebody who's going to be around for a long time. What if the president picked somebody who is relatively moderate, was somebody the Senate was familiar with, has been vetted, has been examined, has been looked at, but is old enough that this person would not be a threat for an extended period of time? So you might look at somebody in their 70s that isn't going to be around, you know, might well leave office when the next president is in. My pet theory would put the first Mainer on the Supreme Court since Melville Fuller. My pet theory is that George Mitchell would be the perfect person for President Obama to nominate for the Supreme Court. He wouldn't stay around a long time. Democrats could support him. Republicans know him. They'd still probably reject him. But I think that would be a great case of the president saying, look, I'm answering your criticisms. Here's somebody who's done tremendous international work on peace in Northern Ireland. He was Senate Majority Leader. He knows how the government works. Mm-hmm. You could almost say, I dare you to stop him, because I really think the unspoken thing in this that nobody wants to talk about is that age factor, because it has become so critical in judicial appointments in the last two or three decades. And I think that's one of the places where President Obama could offer Republicans something that they could say, okay, this isn't going to make this a 5-4 liberal court for the next 20 or 30 years. If we appoint somebody who might be on for 4 or 5 years, might even be somebody who steps down if there's a new president that comes in, and not just because he's from Maine.
Understood. These discussions always become rather ghoulish because we're talking about longevity. And so what you're basically saying is that, I'm going to pick somebody who is going to die soon, and so you don't have to worry too much about it. So age and longevity are going to become a bargaining chip.
Well, let me be less morbid about it. Maybe not necessarily die soon, but step down relatively soon. I mean, we saw Justice Stevens retired so he could enjoy a nice long retirement when mm-hmm. he turned 90. hey, he's in good shape. Why not? It's not impossible that somebody could step down. And that could be part of the discussions in the Senate. You know, how long are you? I mean, if you're somebody, you know, just to bring up George Mitchell's name again, he might not really want to be on the court for 10, 15 years. He might only want to be on that, see what it's like, check that box off in his life. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's waiting for somebody to die, but I would say that age could very easily become a bargaining chip. And I think it's one of the things where you could negotiate, whereas some of the things like abortion politics have been so non-negotiable for people for so long. Or in Justice Bork, or not, he wasn't Justice Bork.
Right.
One of the things that killed off Robert Bork was that Robert Bork would not commit to support the idea of a right to privacy that came out of Griswold versus Connecticut. And at that point, a lot of Democrats said, that's it. That's a non-negotiable. Age is almost inherently negotiable. And it doesn't have to be about dying. It could be somebody who says, look, I'll be on there for 5 years and I promise I'll step down. You could essentially have a self-imposed term limit.
And well, yes and no, but I mean, he could say that during, or she could say that during a confirmation hearing and then simply decide to change his or her mind. It's remarkable the level of independence that develops among Supreme Court justices about a year and a half after they've been on the court and they realize that nobody can fire them and nobody can lower their salaries. That's kind of a nice place to be.
All of Clinton's justices voted against him in Clinton versus Jones. All the appointees of Nixon voted against him in U.S. versus Nixon, the Watergate tapes case. So, yeah, it's true that you could, you know, finesse that a little bit. But I think, you know, being caught as a flat out liar, even for a Supreme Court justice, might not necessarily.
You just change your mind. Jim, you mentioned Justice Stevens, and I have to digress here slightly. You were talking about, you know, why not retire and all the rest of it. But on the other hand, my question would be, why retire? My understanding is, and again, I'm not privy to all the details, is that Justice Stevens spent a lot of his time next to the pool in Florida. And that for years and years, there was a group of people at his condominium complex that simply didn't really know who he was. But he was that guy who was always sitting next to the pool reading. And it turned out that's where he did most of his work. I mean, when he wasn't actually.
Why not?
Exactly. He wasn't wearing his black robe. He wasn't listening to oral arguments. He'd basically gone on to his condo in Florida, sit by the pool, read the briefs, you know, do what he needed to do, communicate with his clerks via telephone or, you know, email or whatever else. It's a great job.
Yeah, it doesn't work as well doing that in the winter in Maine, though. You wouldn't want to be out, you know, at Old Orchard Beach, you know, reading briefs.
Probably not. Maine does have its own set of interesting things.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my buddy, Jim Melcher, a professor of politics at the University of Maine at Farmington, all about what might happen after the death of Justice Scalia. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our conversation with Professor James P. Melcher of the University of Maine at Farmington. Jim has been giving us just fascinating insights into how we're going to resolve this impasse over the next appointment to the Supreme Court. And as we've been discussing, it doesn't look like it's going to be resolved constitutionally. It looks like the political process is going to have to resolve it, if anything does.
Let's shift focus slightly. You know, we're all focusing on who replaces Justice Scalia. A very important question, one that has potential implications for decades. I understand that. But it seems to me there's a larger issue here because this is a presidential election year. We have a Democratic Party and a Republican Party that are widely apart, have vastly different ideas about who should be sitting on the Supreme Court. And whoever wins this next election and who has the advantage of incumbency for reelection is likely to be in office for – well, 8 years, and since that person won't take office for another year, we're talking close to a decade from now. And during that decade, a lot of other Supreme Court justices may either pass away or they may decide that it's time for them to retire and enjoy their golden years. Justice Scalia was not the oldest justice.
No, he wasn't.
And so if nothing else, his death, rest in peace, is something that is focusing people, or at least I hope it will focus people,
on the significance of this presidential election, on the significance of the composition of the United States Senate, and we'll let people know that this next president is likely going to appoint not just Justice Scalia's successor, but maybe two or three others, and maybe more.
Although, of course, one thing to remember is there is never a guarantee you'll get any presidential appointments. Jimmy Carter
But I think it's pretty good. I mean, a lot of these guys are getting close to 80 years old. I mean, well, if we go 10 years from now, it's like, you know, 90.
Yeah, and I don't think that that's an unhealthy thing for people to think about it. I mean, you might have more discussion in this election of the Supreme Court than we have seen in a presidential election in decades, because, you know, let's face it, Roberts, yes, has done a great job getting unanimous rulings on a lot of relatively obscure areas of law that most Americans just don't really care about. But on the really big stuff, you really have a tipping point on affirmative action, on campaign finance, on, you know, police and searches. You've got really sort of a jump ball here with a 4-4, and I think it will make people pay attention. And I think some presidential candidates could turn that into their favor. For example, I think Bernie Sanders could use this to his favor. One of the lead criticisms of Bernie Sanders by those who support Senator Clinton for the Democratic nomination is you're not going to be able to get things done dealing with Republicans in Congress. All the things that we have seen about just how devoted the Republicans are to not giving President Obama a new pick on the Supreme Court plays perfectly into Bernie Sanders' hands. Bernie Sanders can say, look, President Obama can't get them to go along, neither will Hillary Clinton. And this argument against me is a false argument. It's not true. I think it can also play to the hand of somebody kind of coming as a political outsider, as sort of, I'm somebody who's going to come in and bust up this Washington sense of not getting things done, of the bickering, I'm a strong leader. Think of Donald Trump along those lines. Donald Trump could say, you know, Washington needs somebody to break these impasses. This is a function of weak leadership. I think all of this debate very much plays into the hands of a Donald Trump. And to some extent, if Mayor Bloomberg wanted to run, he could say, look, you need somebody who's independent, not tied to the political parties, not tied to the Washington bickering. So I think not only is it a subject that will draw more attention to the court, I think it's something that can actually be something that candidates could use in their favor in their nomination and potentially general election campaigns.
So Donald Trump could say, I'm not only going to force them to accept my nominees for the Supreme Court, I'm going to then make them build a wall around the building and keep them inside.
And I'll make them pay for it. Exactly.
And pay for it as well. Exactly right. Okay. If, in fact, as we've posited, let me make a couple assumptions here. At the moment, and we're recording this at the end of February in 2016, at the moment, the odds-on favorite for the Republican nomination seem to be Donald Trump against everyone's prediction 6 months ago. Yeah. And on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton seems to be living up to what, you know, people thought that she would be the favorite. And assuming after Super Tuesday takes place that that's what happens, and assuming that those are, in fact, the two nominees of the major parties, and assuming further that this impasse continues, who benefits more? Do the Democrats make hay out of this so-called obstructionism? Do they win the moderates over to their side, or do the Republicans, by standing firm for their principles, energize their base and win the general election? Who benefits most from this impasse?
Well, first off, I think both major parties benefit in fundraising. This is something they can use to say, think of the scary, horrible people the other people will apply. Mm-hmm. A lot of fundraising politically these days is based on fear of whoever the opposition party is. So whoever the money people are in either party have to like this. My hunch as to whether the Democrats or Republicans would gain more is that the Republicans would gain slightly more. And this is my reasoning. There's a lot of research in social science that has been done that say people tend to be more afraid of losing something they have than get excited about the possibility of gaining something new. We see this in our healthcare plan at school, that there's two things that come up a year, that if you don't do certain things, they're going to make you pay more, and there's this, you're losing something, or you can get a special benefit later if you do things. The threat of taking away the making you pay more invariably draws more people out. And I think the fear for Republicans of losing what they have and moving to something bad will probably be slightly more exciting for Republicans than the possibility of it moving in another direction will be for Democrats. So my guess is that it will slightly benefit the Republican Party. That said, this election could produce a Democratic president with a Democratic Senate. The Republicans have a lot more seats to protect. And what seats are these? These are the seats the Republicans won in 2010, the year the Tea Party took off. You got a lot of people elected who were pretty conservative Republicans that in an average year might not have done as well, just like Democrats in 2014 had the people who came in with President Obama. So the Republicans that are doing this, rolling the dice, thinking we'll like the situation better in January of 2017, might find that they like the situation a whole lot worse, because I think there's a very good chance that Democrats are going to gain seats in the United States Senate. And if there's a Republican president, what's to stop Democrats from filibustering that nominee?
Yeah, indefinitely. I mean, I don't – it sounds extreme, but for 8 years?
Hopefully not. I think it's bad for democracy to leave these. I think it's bad for people's respect for the government and belief that it can function. And I'm not singling out one party or another here. But I think the big winner, the biggest winner of all in this is cynicism. This makes people say Washington's full of – this is radio – full of nonsense, full of bull feathers, full of horse stuffing.
Yes.
That it just makes people mad about government, and whoever's running as mad about government, I think, profits from this, because they can say, you know, you need somebody to come in with a chainsaw and just bust all this kind of stuff up. And so I think that could work to a Sanders or a Trump's advantage, or Ted Cruz, who's made sort of a career in recent years out of filibusters. I'm not sure which Dr. Seuss book he will select this time. Last time it was Green Eggs and Ham. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll be about the star-bellied Sneetches this time. Mm-hmm. But he could play that up to his base and say, look at me, I'm the fighter. I'm standing up for conservative values. And doing the rest of it. So I think cynicism becomes the big winner. And I would say the same thing if the shoe were on the other foot.
Okay. So on balance, we believe that the Republican tactic of simply refusing to consider a Supreme Court nominee from President Obama is constitutional. And we also think, or at least your assessment is, and I bow to your superior expertise, that on balance, this helps the Republicans politically. So unless Obama and the Democrats have a rabbit they're going to pull out of their hat, it looks like we're going to have an impasse here for the next year, almost.
I think that's a good possibility, unless you get so much of a calculation by enough Republican senators that this is costly for them. I think that would take a much larger shift in public opinion that we have. And the public opinion polls have been very divided. And the funny thing is, the polls that spell out, some say this, you know, the president should wait. Some say we shouldn't have this. Those polls seem to result in people saying the president should make an appointment. The polls that just say, should the president make an appointment or not, come out almost dead even. And I think the thing that could shift things off of what looks like an impasse, and, you know, I'm guessing that it could favor the Republicans. That could well be wrong. You know, a year ago, I thought Jeb Bush was going to be the Republican nominee, and
oops.
I'm thinking that may not be quite. If I knew what was going to happen, I'd win the NCAA basketball tournament pool for, you know, matches or whatever every year. Obviously, we're guessing. But I think the one thing that could shift things was if there were a really large shift in public opinion on the question. But frankly, I don't see that as being particularly likely.
Yeah, I think it's really going to matter a lot as to whom the president picks and exactly what sort of game plan they're coming up with. And I'm guessing that people over at the West Wing are you know, staying up all night and strategizing and talking to people. And let's think about that as well. They can come up with whatever candidate they want to put forward. And normally speaking, if the president of the United States wants to put you forward as a Supreme Court nominee, you're gonna absolutely grasp that. You're gonna embrace that. Now they might say, you know, Jill or Jack or whoever should be this nominee, and Jill or Jack may say thanks but no thanks, because whoever you put up, President Obama, is going to be a sacrificial lamb who will never get confirmed and who never has a chance of being confirmed in the future because he or she will be tainted by this process. I mean, the president might not be able to put forth the person he or she, excuse me, that the president wants to put forward now.
I don't know that I agree with the tainted piece. I think the Senate not acting on, you know, Judge Jane Smith, mm-hmm. I don't think that, if anything, will make Jane Smith a more visible figure, may make her a sympathetic figure. So I don't agree that going through the process would harm you necessarily for later. I do agree that somebody with something to give up is going to be less likely to want to do that. If I have to put my campaign for re-election to the U.S. Senate on hold, or I have to resign as a federal judge to make this happen, I'm not going to want to jump if I think there isn't a place for me to jump to. And that brings me back to my pet theory here in Central Maine of George Mitchell. I think mm-hmm. the president would be well advised to choose somebody who really is not on the upswing of their career, who is not in elective office, who does not – and I think it would be good to have people with experience in elective office. I think it's one of the things the court is missing now. But I think the president is more likely to get somebody to say yes who's got nothing to lose, who's already got a secure name in history, already has a secure reputation, and this could be kind of the finial on it. And if it doesn't work, well, I've already had this great career. What you don't want is somebody feeling like, boy, I've really got to leave a good job, because I think the Republicans have been successful in sending the message, hey, you really don't want to give up your good job now to run a risk on this, because it's going to be aggravating for you. It's going to waste your time, and you might have resigned from your office for nothing.
Yeah, that's a big issue. Well, Jim, we're running out of time here. We started this conversation with you asking me whether the president had called me, and sadly, I've not heard anything from the White House, and so I'm going to turn it around and ask you. So has President Obama called you to nominate you to the court?
Well, you know, our answering machine doesn't work that well, and mm-hmm. you know, sometimes you've seen the telecommunications, so I can neither confirm nor deny that the president has offered the position to I think the president would be – I'm too young, Stuart. I'm you know, in my early 50s. I think the president would run into too much opposition. If it just weren't for different circumstances, I am sure he would be saying, where's the next Melville Fuller from Maine? I know it's my good friend Jim Melcher, but, you know, just circumstances didn't work out this time. Maybe next time, Stuart, we'll be in the mix.
Well, Jim Melcher, professor of politics at the University of Maine at Farmington, thanks so very much for this fascinating, this enlightening discussion of this very, very political but also very, very constitutional question.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure, Stuart.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my buddy Jim Melcher of the University of Maine at Farmington. Isn't he a great guy? He's got those insights, he's got the knowledge, and he's a pretty funny dude sometimes. But I'm going to stop talking about him because he's got a big head, too. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, so get out and get involved in the political process.